Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It's been broadcast on community radio in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. Online at bcfmradio.com. This week, Sue Jones takes a sideways look at rent controls. Also, Pete Edwards is here to talk about Columbia and feminism. And then we have Richard Darm from the English Civil War Centre in Newark with the gruesome story of John Hussey. He was a royalist casualty in the English Civil War, which took place in the 1640s. Just one of 200,000 people that died. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, or go online at Volunteering Bristol. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. And I'll give those details at the end of the show. Well, I'm joined by Sue Jones. And Sue, we're going to start calling these little conversations we have the reports you've been doing sideways. I hope that's all right.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to fair rents? So we've got a high housing crisis at the moment. Too many people for too few houses. And that's pushing up house prices and private rents, causing a lot of problems, particularly for young people. So who are these generation rent people these days?
Well, you're right. Generation rent, that's the term they use for people born after 1980, really, the millennials, as they call them, because they're coming into the housing market when, as you say, the prices are high, it's gone sky high, the rent, the private rents has gone sky high.
And leaving school, really, they're kind of coming into the workplace as well, if they can get a job, round about the millennium.
Yes, that's right. And it's got to the point where not only do most of them have to rent because they can't afford deposits to buy, but it's more expensive now to rent than to have a mortgage. But they're stuck there. There's no way they can get out of it.
Any idea how many people this is affecting? What proportion of the population, roughly, or not?
Yes. Of the whole population nowadays, for that younger generation, it's practically half of them. 48% are in private rented accommodation.
So this is, I'm thinking, around about 18 to 25, roughly. Is that what we're talking?
Well, it's up to 35.
Up to 35, okay.
Up to 35. And that's twice as much as it was even 10 years ago. So it's a really increasing phenomenon.
You know what? A lot of that generation have been to do degrees and are now having to leave college or university with an enormous amount of debt as well.
I know.
So private rents are very high. Young people have got a lot of debt. Has it always been like this?
No. And the reason I got interested in this, because I started off working in a citizens' advice bureau quite a long time ago. And
are you allowed to say where?
The way that English people pronounce this was Y strangulus, but the Welsh proper way of pronouncing it was Ystrygymlais. So there we go.
So that's in South Wales.
That was in South Wales, that's right. And when we learned about housing, we learned about fair rents, and that if you felt your rent was too high, you could contact the council, they get their rent offer to tell you what the rent should be, and then they would write to the landlord and yourselves, and the landlord could only charge that fair rent, I sort of grew up thinking that was the normal way, and it seemed very fair and reasonable, but that was scrapped. And when I looked into the history, these rent controls were introduced in the First World War, when there weren't enough houses being built because they were diverting all the efforts to the munitions and all that sort of thing. But they wanted to stop people just charging the earth because there weren't enough houses. So they brought in rent controls in the First World War, and then they kind of frittered away afterwards. And then back in the Second World War, back they came again, full control. And then after the Second World War, they started going away again. And then they came back in 1965 when the Labour government got back in, and they sort of had rent regulation on quite a big scale. And that's when they introduced the fair rents and the rent officers and protected tenancies. And so when you got a tenancy, you could have it for quite a long time. You could get a fair rent, and it could only be raised within certain, you know, limits, and that it was a quite a fair situation for people who were renting private properties.
Yes, but I mean, as a, if you're a landlord, you want to be able to charge whatever the market will bear, don't you? So you, if you think that the rents are generally going up in your area, maybe over 3 or 4 years, they could go up quite a lot. You want to be able to raise yours to whatever the market will bear. I mean, surely that's the way the free market's supposed to operate.
Well, that's right. And so when the Conservatives came in 1989, then they, one of the first things they did was start deregulating tenancies so that most of them now are not protected tenancies. I'll give you an example of a protected tenancy. So there are flats overlooking Hampstead Heath. The ones that are protected tenancies, which are very few and far between these days, a one-bedroom flat, they pay £348 a month. Now, nearby, the market, you know, at the market value, the rate is five times that. They're charged £1,500. So that gives you an example of how high things have got on the open market compared to when they were protected.
But surely that's okay when people are being paid an enormous amount of money, the actual wages going up to meet that demand.
Well, are they? No. Tenancies, rents have increased by twice what wages have increased by. So they've, you know, they haven't, people's wages haven't been able to keep up with them.
Okay, rent. So why are these private rents so high? Why do you think?
Well, because they can, because there isn't enough housing. People can't afford, young people can't afford to buy properties. The amount of social rented housing has gone down and down. And an interesting thing there is that when the government sold under the right to buy council housing to the tenants, the idea was that they would become homeowners.
This is in the 1980s mainly,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I know. And 40% of the properties that were sold under right to buy, the socials, are now rented privately. So it's... there's no win, really.
Also, I would probably say, well, one of the other reasons that private rents are so high is because the demand has gone up. You've just said that. But also, the demand has gone up because there's been a lot of immigration. We've had, I think, isn't it 300,000 people coming into Britain every year for the last, well, 5-6 years at least?
There has been a lot. And the population in the country as a whole has increased 10 million people in recent years. So it's gone up a lot, you're right. So there are a lot more people here for various reasons.
And also add as well, I think that the... I mean, I can remember from... This is from the 1980s, 1990s, economists saying that the government keeps a very, very close eye on house prices and rents. It knows that if house prices or rents start to go down, it's an indication that the whole of the rest of the economy may be about to follow it. So they do everything they can. I mean, we had George Osborne doing this with his so-called right to buy. It wasn't right to buy, was it? Help to buy. That's right. The help to buy scheme from a couple of years ago, which one of the house builders I spoke to actually said it's actually really should be called the help to sell scheme, because it meant that it was making it easier for house builders, including people who were involved in private as well as those who were selling off houses, to sell those houses, because the people, I mean, it's a bit like the subprime mortgage crisis, where people were given a bit of extra help in order to take out a bigger loan than they could really afford to pay back. So that one of the biggest problems seems to be that a lot of people are building houses or are planning permission for houses, but they're not actually building them because people do not have the money to buy them. Also, another thing is I've seen adverts, a lot of adverts now for new housing schemes say great investment opportunity. So they're not even really pitching them at people who are likely to buy them to live in. People maybe taking their money out of other forms of investment like commodities or the stock exchange, and they don't actually see the house as a place to live anymore. It's more just a place to keep your money, which is safer than the stock exchange.
That's right. It's an investment opportunity. And estate agents bump says, you know, we'll yield 6%. You know,
they're artificially propping up the housing market, yeah, to try and make it look as if the economy's doing well. So that, you know, this is one of the reasons that these amounts are having to go up and up and up, is because the housing market is, I suppose, it's the one thing that we all absolutely need. And so maybe they can ratchet it up a bit more than the other things. And also worth mentioning is the difference between how much a house costs to build and how much it costs to buy it. Because in bricks and mortar terms and, you know, the labour to actually build a house, I'm talking about wood, you know, basically kitted out electrically, to actually build it. So you're talking about materials and labour to build a house. That's going to cost you maybe something like £60,000, something like that, to build a, say, 2-3-bedroom house. Now, it's nothing like the amount it's going to cost you to buy it. In some places, you're talking about, you know, maybe £500,000 even. And all of that is just the scarcity value, the fact that it is so difficult to actually get on the housing ladder that profits and can be jumped up.
That's right. We need 200,000 homes a year built every year, and we haven't had that for years. And in fact, we had 150,000 built a couple of years ago. And before that, under David Cameron, it was the lowest rate of building for 100 years. So we're really getting very short of housing, which is, as you say, why the prices have gone up so much. If we look back to just 10 years ago, as I said before, the number of young people in private rented properties has doubled, and it's now just about half of them are in private rentals. That's up to the age of 35. And the number who own their own properties aged under 35 is halved from what it was 10 years ago. So that it's a really big shift in the last 10 years.
That's interesting, because that's mostly Conservative, Lib Dem, been in government, and yet they're supposed to be the so-called property-owning parties. They want everyone to own properties, and yet less and less people are.
Well, there were opportunities, as you say, for buy-to-let mortgages, which... you know, and so now there are 2 million landlords in Britain, and a lot of them have only got one or two properties. They don't really know how to be landlords. A lot of the properties are not kept at the really good rate of repair, and that's another big problem with private rented. And the other big problem, so you've got the high rents, the poor condition, is there's no security of tenure. So you might get a 6 or 12 months, and then you can have 2 months' notice and you're out for doing nothing wrong whatsoever. But because the owner decides either they want to put the rent up and you don't want to pay the higher rent, or they just say, no, you've got to go.
And well, one of the excuses, just to warn people, if you've not heard this already, that landlords often use is they'll say to you, oh, we need to do some repairs to your house. I'd like to move you out. Can you find somewhere else for a month and then you can come back? And then you find, of course, that the place has been rented out to somebody else. So it's just really an excuse to get you out quicker than they could do legally.
Yes, well, I haven't heard that. But
well, they also know that if you're evicted, if you get a letter saying you've got to be out in 2 months, quite often people will not pay any rent for that 2 months, and sometimes they'll even trash the place or give the keys to somebody else and let them live there, and then they have to be then evicted by the landlord. So nowadays, when if you get a notice to quit from your landlord, quite often people will, you know, just simply say, well, we're not going to pay you any more rent and we'll have to spend this time looking for somewhere else. So the relationship of trust between tenant and landlord is going down the tubes.
And another thing that worries me is not just that young people are having to rent, but more and more families with children have to have private rentals now. And that's gone up 3 times in the last 10 years. So it was 500,000 families in 2004 were in private rented accommodation, and now it's 1.5 million families with children, which is an awful lot. And what it means is they have no security. The average length of stay in private rents is 3.5 years, and compared to like 17 years if you own your own home. So you'd have to face moving jobs, possibly moving schools. It's very disruptive for the whole family and not fair on children at all.
So why have rents risen so much more than inflation?
Well, I think it's largely what you said before, because there aren't any controls. The average private rent now is nearly £800 a month. And they've gone up.
That's here in Bristol, is it?
Well, that's across the country. Okay. I don't know what it is in Bristol. And people under 35 are paying 40% of their income on rent now, whereas if they've got a mortgage, they're paying 20% on mortgage payments. So it's the odds are stacked against people who have to...
It's funny, isn't it? Rip off Britain, it sounds like to me. I was just seeing the other day that the train fares in Britain are roughly 15% of your annual income to get to work on the train in Britain, whereas in France and Germany, it's 3 or 4%. So it just seems that there are rackets going on here in Britain. And when it comes to renting a property, tenancy, or on the train. You know, we're being overcharged just simply because they can. There's no proper regulation of anything.
No, and the higher that rents get, then the more people have to apply to housing, to councils for housing benefit to help them pay the rent. And basically that's our money, that's government money, that's going to private landlords.
It's a subsidy, isn't it?
It is.
Public subsidy of overcharging landlords.
40% of housing benefit, which was £25 billion for the whole year, 40% of that is going to private landlords. So it's costing all of us a lot of money to have these high rents. And when this generation becomes pensioners and they haven't got their own homes, then, and their income drops then, they're going to need all their rents possibly paid by housing benefits, so that'll increase it even more.
So have you had a look at solutions? What might be possibly a way out of all of this? So?
Yes, I have. But one thing to say first is that it's the biggest cause of homelessness, people coming out of private rented, when they're given notice to leave for no good reason, you might say. They've paid their rent, they've kept the place nice, they're told to leave, and that's the biggest cause of homelessness, which is now a very big problem. Yes, so what to do? There's a survey done, and 60% of people in Britain want new legal controls on privately rented housing. So there's quite a lot of public support for legal controls, and before long, there will be about one-sixth of all constituencies in the country will have more renters than owners in their constituency. So it's going to be quite a political factor, I would say, at the next election to get more protection for private renters. And so what needs to be done is obviously need to build more houses and flats so that you reduce the scarcity value.
But hang on, you can't do that. Because that will maybe reduce the value of housing. If we start to meet the demand, you're going to start to reduce the value of housing, the prices of housing. You might even reduce, although it does seem to work on a ratchet, doesn't it, only in one direction, rents even. And that would be, the Treasury would say, a disaster for the economy.
Well, you could say it, well, except it will cost the Treasury a lot less in housing benefits, won't it, if rents go down to a reasonable level and more people can afford their own rent than having to get help from the government.
Well, good point. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
That's all right. So you need to build more houses and flats, and you need to control rents. They've started this in Scotland already this year. They've got a Private Tenancies Act, which limits rent rises to inflation plus 1%. So that's and there are various controls for rents in other countries that could be looked at to see which is the best one. Longer tenancies is something that Shelter is really pressing for. They would like, you know, the charity for homeless people, they would really like 5-year tenancies and to end no-fault evictions, so that unless people have done something that is, you know, very wrong.
But how can somebody sell their house then? If they're a buy-to-let landlord, they can't sell their house, can they? Because they can't sell it, surely, with somebody in renting.
They can sell with a sitting tenant, but it reduces the value. But that's, you know, that's part of the game you're in, if you're a landlord.
If you're a buy-to-let landlord, I would have thought if you've got a tenant who you can show is a reliable payer, that you could actually maybe sell the house with them in it, you know? Then another buy-to-let landlord would like to buy a house with a reliable payer in there.
Indeed, yeah. So, I mean, I think basically something needs to be done, and this is becoming a big crisis, and it's costing the country a lot of money already, all of us, our government.
Well, we're subsidising the landlords, aren't we?
Yeah, and the sooner we can get...
It's like benefits for the landlords, not for the people who are in there. It's more, you know, so much money is going to a landlord, it's not actually doing anything.
No, absolutely. So action needs to be taken quite soon, or else the country won't be able to afford this problem, far less individuals.
I wonder if anything is going to actually cause this to be dealt with, though, because it does seem as if, you know, the Conservatives at the moment are pretty much a landlord party. They're there in the interests of the people who are the buy-to-let landlords. And at the moment, that suits them quite well, doesn't it, to have public subsidy for their own voters.
But if more and more people are having to privately rent because they can't afford houses and there aren't enough social housing properties, then there will, you know, more and more people will really want to change the government policy on this because they're in a dreadful position.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth saying that here in Bristol, we've just got a grant, I believe, to help people who are in a situation where they may be about to be evicted, so they're not then homeless. So there are things being done to address this. So I just wonder, you know, if you've got any advice from your days at Citizens Advice about where people can go if they've got looks like they might be being evicted, they're not sure about the legalities of it, or they think they're being cheated by their landlord. Is there anywhere to go to talk to people about getting a bit of advice?
Well, as you say, Citizens Advice is a good place to go. And the other organisation that is excellent on housing particularly is Shelter. They have a helpline.
Well, they've got offices here in Bristol, both of them, haven't they, as well?
So they're very good at it as well.
The trouble is, of course, people quite often think, oh gosh, you know, they don't want to deal with it because it's such a complete nightmare to have to deal with getting evicted for something where you're, you know, you've got to move all your belongings. You know, often people are in denial, aren't they?
Well, if you're faced with an eviction notice, you've got to do something, haven't you?
Yeah. So go and get some advice, folks, if you're in that sort of situation. And also, I suppose the other thing to do is to take a very close look at social housing, because the social housing rents are so much more sensible. I mean, you're talking about, you know, less than half quite often of what you're paying as to a private landlord.
But the problem there, Tony, is there's 5 million people on the housing waiting list. There's a lot of people queuing up for social housing.
Well, apparently the council, they say to you now, if you're a man, I don't know about what the situation is for women and children, if you're a man on your own, then you'll probably die before they'll get you anywhere on the housing list. Anyway, on that cheerful note, we'll leave it till another time. Sideways with Sue Jones, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect again.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined by Pete Edwards now. Pete's been on this programme before, and he's a regular visitor backwards and forwards to Columbia, living in Somerset at the moment. Thankfully, we've got him here. I don't know why you're here in the winter. You must be crazy. Surely, Pete, you want to be in Columbia at this time of year?
I certainly would, yes. And I know Columbia sort of has that reputation as being like a dangerous country, and it is. You know, there's a lot of problems there. I finally come back here, and sometimes I fear more for my life in this country walking down the high street.
Really?
Yeah. Easily.
Why?
I think, for instance, you know, obviously there's a lot of crime there, but it's crime because the people are poor. You know, and here there's crime, but there's crime because people are, like, corrupt. You know, like there's something like a spiritual poverty that happens in this country. And whereas we've got, like, a material richness in Colombia and in a lot of other countries around the world, they have, like, material poverty, but they've got, like, a spiritual wealth.
That's a nice way of putting it, because actually in a lot of ways, you know, go around the world and you'll find some of the poorest people are the most generous, even though they've got so little materially to give. Anyway, so we've dragged you in here again, Pete, to talk about really about feminism. But before we do, we're going to talk about Marxism, because they're sort of linked. But anyway, what are your thoughts about the way Marxism has impacted in South America? I mean, you've been mainly to Colombia, but to other countries. And I'd be just interested to know whether you think it's, you know, it's a great philosophy. Mm. Have some of the people who've liberated countries over there from the colonies, like the Spanish, etc., used Marxism?
I mean, you know, for me to sort of understand it and to understand, like, an alternative to Marxism, because I grew up in this country, in Britain, and I didn't go to university, but I also had, like, affiliation, wanting to find something different, something that would change the society. And naturally, when one has grown up and they've sort of got more of, like, an intellectual bent, they get Marxism appeals to people, so they read it, and it makes sense. You read it, and it sounds like a very great solution.
Well, I mean, it's supposed to be one of the most important things historically, most influential thinkers, Marx was, and he did quite a lot of good work in digging out some of the reasons why you've got the class system, for example.
Sure. Now, I mean, you know, we say that there's good things in the bad, and there's bad things in the good. And as equally, there are a lot of good things that you can find in Marxism. I'm sure there is.
But well, tell us a bit about Marx, because you've had quite a look into him, and some of the, you know, certainly on the surface it seems to be been very, very influential, but some partly tainted as well.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I follow that adage that, you know, you don't pick fruit amongst the thorns. It's what Christ says in the Bible, as in, you know, if you want to know what a person is like, see what they're doing, see what they're actually like. You know, it's not the ideas in our heads or what we're saying, it's more the actions in our lives that determine the kind of quality of person that we are. And so in that sense, Marx had great intellectual ideas, but if you actually look and study the actual, like, his way of life, in contrast to those ideas, you can see actually there's a lot of hypocrisy there.
So what in Marx's life was hypocritical there?
So, for instance, in his Marxist philosophy, it's a materialistic philosophy that in some way sort of forbids the use of, like, religion. And yet Marx himself was a fanatical Jew. Marx speaks about sort of equality and sort of trying to, like, raise up the society and sort of liberate people, yet he himself was like a scrounger that often borrowed money from people. So it makes me wonder, how can someone who is living that life then propose to have a society? It's like, you know, you can't give to people what you don't have. Like, we in this country, we don't have freedom, so we cannot export democracy to people if we're not.
We do have quite a lot of freedom, don't we? We certainly have some more freedom of expression than somewhere like China.
Mm-hmm. Right, I wouldn't know. I haven't been to China. I suppose I'd say in this country, where it's getting dangerous is a sort of the freedom to be able to express like another point of view. It's not with the status quo. Status quo, pardon me.
Well, it certainly looks like that's where things are going. But anyway, what's Marx's role in this whole sort of left versus right business? Because that's what's happened over the years, is you've got this kind of, in the States too, you've got a kind of left-wing party and a right-wing party, and some would say that actually they're playing a bit of a game with us, that, you know, that there are terminally fatal things wrong with both sides.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's that whole sort of law of the pendulum, that if you, like, push the pendulum to one side, eventually that pendulum is going to come back to the other extreme. And so in that sense, capitalism has not been something by itself. Capitalism has had to have communism as its enemy, as its shadow, in order to sustain the capitalism. So in the capitalist society, it's there, its trademark, if you like, is to do with patriarchy, male dominance, about there's the boss. And so it's this dominating society. And in the contrast to that, you have the communism. And that's why you see places like the United States, and very nearby you had Cuba, as kind of like a little example of what the capitalism isn't. And so by doing that, you're sort of creating this controlled opposition. And by creating that controlled opposition, but essentially what you're doing is always keeping something in place. Now, in a capitalist society, I mean, we're not capitalists. I don't go out and earn loads of money and don't wear a top hat. It's like the people who have capital are the elites. And essentially the opposite of where Marxism was coming from is that when, rather than money, what fuels a communist society is efficiency, is that the purpose of the thing that drives society is not to actually be making money and making profit, but make things more efficient, make things more effective. So essentially, you know, on the ground, we're living in a communist society, but we're handing around gaming tokens to one another, which we call money, which we can never actually save up and make enough capital ourselves. It's all like a part of some big game. So in that capitalist society, when that's like crumbling and falling down, it's, if you like, natural that the thing which arises from the ashes of that capitalist society is communism. And whereas capitalism is driven by patriarchy, driven by male dominance, communism finds its expression in the opposite, which is matriarchy, in feminism. Now, why is feminism there a problem?
Well, yeah, but I mean, how can you say that communism is feministic? I mean, you know, there's certainly the left wing in this country, most other countries, does push the idea of gender equality, but that's not the same as saying that communism's feminism.
Mm-hmm. I think more the point is in order to, it's this question of divide and conquer. So when you create something like capitalism, you need communism as its antipole, and basically from that rise from the left, it's like, you know, you vote in the Democrats, you know, the left, and then you take the next footstep, you vote in the Republicans, right, and so it's all marching forward, left, right, and essentially this is kind of what goes on in the society. So you create a division, something like, you know, I mean, I want to make a distinction there between women's liberation, between women being free, having all the same, and we are all on this planet together, trying to find a way to survive. And this is not something which I'm bringing into question. It's more the actual that ism in there, because that ism means a preference towards.
Well, the trouble is, I mean, it seems to me, looking at right and left, is you've got, from the right, you've got enormous, hardwired into that economic inequality, where you've got some people who can barely survive, barely feed themselves, barely house themselves, and others who have massive amounts of wealth and land, more than they could ever walk on or ever spend. You know, so that is very much part of the right.
Sure.
And you know, no society can survive with those levels of resource inequality.
Absolutely.
And with the left, a lot of what the left seems to be doing is about the destruction of the family. That is to say, a massive not kind of nanny state, looking after elderly people so that the family doesn't having enormous unemployment and paying for people who to not work. And then also not really supporting people in marriage. So for a long time, I don't know what the situation is now.
Yeah.
You know, it's just simply, you know, there's for tax reasons, people look at the tax reasons and say, actually, no, if we get married, we're going to be worse off, you know. So,
well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, look at that, you know, where are the priorities of the society that we're living in? Because, you know, if someone's got, let's say, a very hard-working man, a very, you know, hard-working woman, come together, try and make a family, but they're poor, it would be harder for them to get a property or to get a place to live. But if a family is dysfunctional, if the woman has broken up or the man's in prison and she has lots of children, then essentially a divorced, broken family gets a higher priority. So in that sense, our society has it as a higher priority for broken families. You know, actual fixed families, families that work, actually of no consequence to the society. And why is that? I find this very interesting, is because if you create a division, it's like an atom, it's a unit, and you split the atom, you destroy it. And all the energy that's released there, it's essentially like a unit, in the same like the family unit. The family unit is kind of something which we all come from. Our whole ancestral lineage is born through this whole unit called the family. They're in nature, they need to survive, and so there's something that binds them together. Like, there's an instinctual mechanism inside them, brings them together, makes them survive, makes them overcome their
problems.
Well,
a lot of it is to do with money, isn't it? Because British society has become totally dependent on money. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to get from A to B, if you're going to eat, if you're going to actually spend the night without getting evicted from your home, you need money.
Aye. And you find that in these indigenous societies, or in the sort of the primordial societies, is that there was no social benefit system, there was no means to get money. And so essentially, when you have that, like that carrot dangling there as social benefits, there's families in this country, essentially there's no instinctual necessity for people to stay together in families, because at the end of the day, someone can think, well, I can break up with my partner, I can get social benefits. So in that sense, having the state there, as good as it is to actually help people who are in need, on the dark side of it is that also it does something, as it destroys that survival instincts of a family staying together.
Well, having said that, of course, you know, after the last 6-7 years of Lib Dem and Tories, there's been kind of a slow strangulation of the benefit system over here, which has been really, really difficult for a lot, including, I mean, disabled people. Just on the BBC Points West tonight, I was looking at that, and there's some poor disabled guy. It looks as if he's going to be losing his independent living allowance, which means he'll be stuck at home. He won't be able to go out. He'll have to have people looking after him. But then the local authority in Gloucestershire is saying, oh, we might not be able to afford that. So effectively, they're just leaving disabled people, or at least that's what they're now talking about, to try and fend for themselves in this this world, you know, to compete, you know, which is just an appalling kind of behaviour.
I'm definitely not saying that we should just scrub the benefit system, but it's more a case that because that system's there in place, that we don't see what evil it does.
Yeah, I think what seems to have happened, Pete, is that we've had the benefit system put in place in a situation where there wasn't that much unemployment, maybe back in the 60s and 1970s, and slowly but surely, you know, the amount that we need every week has gone up and up and up when it comes to rent, when it comes to all the utilities. They've all been privatised, etc. And so now there are multi-millions of more people dependent on benefits, even when they're working full-time, they're having to claim benefits.
I'd say, just one, going back to this issue of the feminism, and in order to sort of try and make people see a different perspective on what's happening in the society. If you look at what's going on in the United Nations, what's going on with a lot of powerful people around the world, is that certain women are being put into place, and they appeal to people because they seem like it's going to be a different system. like Vandana Shiva, like Theresa Watson.
Hang on, Theresa May. Are we talking about Angela Merkel? What?
If you want to, just,
I mean, surely
just
that's just a,
women,
that's
yeah.
just an expression of more women arriving in international politics.
There's, sure,
they're certainly mostly men, aren't they?
Well, essentially, even the women themselves, if you actually sort of think about it, it's not a case that these women are very, like, feminine and lovely people. It's
well, no, Margaret Thatcher definitely wasn't, was she?
No, you know, she actually advocated a lot, oh, women need to be women and everything. And if you think about it, when someone like that is telling women to be women, people just think, oh, goodness, I won't follow her advice. So it's the whole thing. Sometimes the bad guy in the film actually tells you the good bit of advice which you need to hear, because it's the bad guy, people don't necessarily... listen to it.
So are you trying to say that you think men are better at running things than women?
No. I think man and woman need to cooperate. They need to have balance between them. You know, they are sort
well,
of
that's what surely what feminism is about. It's about giving women equal opportunities with men that are into roles which have traditionally male-only roles.
Mm-hmm. Those, you know, from my understanding, it's like a lot of roles have been put there from nature. So, for instance, I've noticed that I've gone to live in a place very far, far away from the road, far from civilization. And in that environment, they made like a bit of an experiment. They let some of the women like cook food in the kitchen. They let some of the men like be in the kitchen. The women go and carry like very, very sort of large loads on their back. And what they noticed there is that by sort of changing those gender roles, women had a problem in labour, giving childbirth. And men being in the kitchen meant that a lot of people were getting ill. Because for some reason there's something there, as in women have a kind of sense of hygiene. As you know, they're beautiful, they're lovely, and for that reason there's something about them which has that kind of grace. And men don't necessarily have that. They're much more sort of rough and a bit more, you know, I'd say a bit less hygienic. And we notice that there's a reason why nature put those roles there, that when we're living in nature, it makes sense why there's those gender roles.
But all the great restaurants of the world, you know, the Savoy or whatever, you'll find mostly men doing the cooking there.
Sure.
So you're saying you might get poisoned if you go in them?
Right, well, you know, I think if they took those chefs and put them in the jungle and left them there for, you know, a few weeks without running water and without, you know, all this, we'll see what happens.
Well, what about, anyway, let's get back to Marx and feminism, because, you know, it seems that there might be a bit of a connection between the two.
Mm-hmm. So, for me to, like, you know, to actually have understood Marx better, I had to understand the works of Simón Bolívar. And Simón Bolívar, he was the liberator of South America. He liberated Bolivia, and is the name of that country, gets the name from Simón Bolívar. Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador.
This is all from the Spanish and Portuguese, is it?
All from the Spanish and Portuguese, but equally from US imperialism. Like, Bolívar was very aware that the US were acting as like the world leaders. And so if you read the works of Simón Bolívar, he's saying stuff there in the 1850s onwards that is reflecting the situation that's happening today with the US imperialism. And this guy was a socialist, but he was not, like, how to say, he was not in bed with the aristocracy. This guy knew where the enemy was. He knew that there was an elite that had gone to South America and were basically draining the poor and exploiting the indigenous. And his idea was like, you know, how come we are there working for these landlords when we could just be living on the land and living in a free and equal society? And this guy's, Simón Bolívar's ideas were far superior to Marx in terms of like making like a socialist society.
So what was his vision then for South America, and maybe, you know, the ideas that might, who knows, spread to Europe at some point?
Well, and his vision of South America, and it's not just his vision, there's an energy there in South America, and people can tap into that energy, like Che Guevara and other revolutionaries in South America, that they felt that there was, like, what you could say, like the South American dream. And it's very similar to what you say is like the original North American dream of basically people being free, living on the land, and having the right to be whatever it is they want to be. And with Bolivar, he essentially put that into practice. He went and he liberated 5 countries. This guy was on horseback, and he went through amazing, immense hardships to actually like bring this dream to reality. And for me, I think that's like a contrast between someone like Bolivar, who for me is one of the greatest people who's ever lived since the time of Christ. You know, in terms of actually like the top 10 people or people who've actually had influence.
So what was he doing? I suppose he was going around getting rid of the existing rulers at the time, the elite at the time, the colonial elite. Mm-hmm. The trouble is, of course, you quite often get a situation where the people that you have left over, once you've got rid of the elite by whatever means, you know, I don't have the skills to actually keep the country going, manage things efficiently.
Yeah. Essentially, that's what happened with Bolivar as well. At the end of his life, he was betrayed by his nearest and dearest. especially by someone called Santander. And Santander became more like the leader of Colombia, because the nations he liberated was called Gran Colombia, Great Colombia. And as he was dying, he realised actually there were sort of elements, the selfish elements that were coming up in the people. It's like, you know, anyone who comes and has a vision and tries to start up movements, you know, they might be very, like, a great thinker, a great liberator, like a very, you know, human kind of person. And yet always in the ashes of their work, someone else comes and picks it up and it's taken over by people who are sort of more egotistical, more, you know, controlled.
Almost hijacked, really.
Essentially,
what about what about Hugo Chavez?
Right. Well, yeah, Chavez is another example of that energy, of that spirit of revolution, the spirit of liberation, which comes in and manifests in the people. And Chavez, when you look at him, he's part black, he's part Indian, he's part European. This man was of Venezuela. And in terms, you just sort of see what the actions that Chavez did in Latin America, in Venezuela. For instance, there was a big flood in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, and he housed about 30 to 40 families in the presidential palace. He just brought them in because he thought, well, you know, they need housing. This guy was for the people. He was from the people. And he tried to liberate. He tried to set up like a military coup in 1992, which failed. He went to prison for that. But he became a public hero, and essentially he came out. He spent all his time in prison just reading about politics, and then when he left prison, he got into politics. And the aristocracy at the time thought, well, we own the media, we own everything. There's no way that someone like Chavez, from the people, who's got... And when the vote came, people voted for Chavez. And that was a very big surprise.
Now, there are rumours that he was poisoned by the CIA.
Well, there's also...
Do you know anything about that?
I mean, there's rumours there as well. He got poisoned by Cuba. Now, I know a lot of people sort of... Cuba has that image in people's minds as being like this Latin American revolution.
Yeah, because he went to Cuba for treatment, didn't he?
He went to Cuba for treatment, that's right.
For cancer.
Yeah, and they gave him scorpion poison as a means to sort of cure the treatment. And I haven't seen him, but I've heard that there's been, like, things that have been leaked that have said Raul Castro has had, like, a connection with that. This is something that one should research, but definitely take my word for it. If anyone's interested in this, try and understand that Cuba has not been a true spirit of South American revolution. Cuba has been, like, the communist, Marxist... controlled opposition that the United States have allowed to be in there. I mean, if the CIA wanted to assassinate someone, they would do it, you know. And that the fact there's been 600 supposed attempts against Fidel Castro's life, that Fidel Castro has been in Hollywood films, that he was sponsored and had sponsorship from the United States, there is enough evidence out there to actually, and even looking at what's going on now in the process of the peace in Colombia, that what Cuba have done essentially is turned the plight of the Colombian people into the plight of the Marxist plight. And the Colombian people are not happy about that because the Colombian want their own culture. They don't want a foreign culture.
It's funny, isn't it? Almost every revolution or revolutionary gets, even if they manage to succeed in their revolution, it doesn't seem to take long before someone comes along, takes it over, hijacks it. Who knows if that's even happened in Cuba? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Anyway, look, let's get back to feminism, because I know you think that there are some links with colonialism. So just take us through that. That's an interesting connection, if there is one.
I'm not sure.
How modern colonialism, you know, is happening, where countries are now being taken over much more quickly, and feminism is part of the toolkit.
That's what you mean. Well, yes.
Part of the toolkit.
Goodness, that's
a bit of a leap, yeah.
That's quite a chest to open up there, you know. So in order to understand colonialism, imperialism, you know, we're talking about, you know, taking a native indigenous people, taking them off the land and putting them into the system where they're no longer living in nature. They're living in another order, not the natural order, a new world order. And so that's that order. It follows the whole footsteps of imperialism, of colonialism.
Well, I mean, it follows the footsteps, actually, of enclosure in Britain.
Absolutely,
where
back to this country.
People were very, very, you know, had good security of tenure, not a lot of working hours. Yeah. Apparently, they used to start work about 1 o'clock in the afternoon and finish about four.
Right.
That was in the ordinary villages.
Okay.
And they would work on the collective fields, basically these gigantic allotments. And then enclosure came along. That land was privatised, given to one landowner. They called it the Industrial Revolution, but you ended up with loads of people with nowhere to live, sleeping in ditches.
Essentially, yes. You know, what happened to the Celtic race, to the indigenous of this island, is something that took many centuries for that to actually unfold, for that to be able to destroy their spirituality, bring in Christianity, put in the land rights, you know, take away the monarchy, put in parliament, put in democracy, put the industrial revolution, agricultural revolution, to the point that people are divorced, ripped away from the nature and put in to the imperialistic system. When that culture is then infected, they then cut down all the trees, they take that force of nature and turn that into imperialism. They make the warships, they go out, they then invade other countries. And so then that's what took centuries here to do, to accomplish in the British imperialism. When it went to the United States with the US imperialism, they managed to do that in a space of decades. Go to a country, bring in Christianity, change their land rights, you know, change their indigenous spirituality to something else.
I'm a bit puzzled as to what Christianity's got to do with it, because no.
Rights... Yeah, in all fairness, it's, when I say Christianity, I don't mean
You see, in South America, you've got this whole thing called liberation theology, which has actually been a very positive force for civil rights, human rights, and actually the church, particularly... some individuals in the Catholic Church have been the only people really speaking out for human rights in quite a, you know, otherwise mechanised US colony.
Sure. And I sort of I bring it up because, for instance, how that manifested in the Celtic culture was that after 1066 and all that time, before there was already like a there was already like a pagan Christianity, like a Celtic Christianity. That was all. It sort of manifested through the whole sort of Arthurian myths. And when you read those stories, you see actually there's something very Christic in those stories.
Well, but then hang on, because if you're talking about the Arthurian myths, I thought that was just invented by the Abbot of Glastonbury as a way of kind of marketing thing back in medieval times. I might be wrong, but there's no real factual basis in Arthur, is there?
Well, if I say read the stories of King Arthur, not of the Arthur himself, read the knights. What happens with those knights? Because the impression we got is all like warmongering and, you know, men slapping women in the face. But read those stories and you'll see there all the stories about a man having to overcome his weaknesses in order to gain the love and respect of a woman. And in that sense, this is something which is something there, like a myth. It's a story. It's a spiritual teaching as to how to sort of sustain a family, how to sustain a culture, as in a man has to overcome himself in order to allow a woman to overcome herself. And if you actually read those stories, not a case of did it happen or historically all this, actually look at the spiritual teaching behind it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's certainly a lot of good moral tales in it, but I don't think it's got much.
I'd like to go there and ask this. I'd like to finish off answering the question.
I've diverted you a bit. Carry on.
So, this thing with the what happened in the British culture to make British imperialism from that Celtic indigenous culture took centuries. The United States then took that imperialistic energy, and they then managed to do in decades what took centuries in Europe. And so when they go in that, and now they're refining it even more. So what they're doing now is that they're finding ways to basically come into a community and just divide it, split it in half. And in that sense, feminism is that Trojan horse. They can go to an indigenous culture, the UN, UN women, different groups. They can go into the indigenous cultures and essentially say, the problem is men. The problem is, you know, that you're doing all this like chores and it doesn't have to be like this. And these women, we should be going there learning from the indigenous, you know, not us going there and telling them how to live, because they're living with nature. They're living in close harmony with their ancestors. And essentially, you know, they're not the ones who should be changing. We're the ones who should be like listening to them.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now back to the third part of our piece on the English Civil War Centre in Newark. Richard Darn is taking us on a tour of it, and this week, in our final piece, he takes us on the gruesome journey round one of the galleries where we find a chap called John Hussey, who was a royalist and was shot during the Civil War. He was one of 200,000 people that died, with 600,000 casualties in the entire war, of which 200,000 died. That was out of a population of around about 4 million people. So what is that? Around about 5%. Of the people died. Now compare that to the First World War and the Second World War. So 5% died in the English Civil War in the 17th century. In the Second World War, around about 1% of British population died in that. That was 400,000 people died out of 45 million. If we go back to World War One, 2% of the British population died in that, which was a population a bit lower back then, which was 42 million, and 900,000 people died in World War One. Almost all, of course, men. So we go now to listen to Richard Darn from the English Civil War Centre up in Newark.
Death awaited us all. And Prince Rupert was triumphant. Muscombe Ford was captured. 100 men died in defence of this town. Fathers, sons, my nephew.
We said a little bit earlier, one of the ideas of the Civil War Centre, it's such a complicated war, it's multifaceted, as we've, you know, talked about, that it's nice sometimes to reduce the entire conflict down to the experience of one man. Until very recently, we had the armour, the breastplate of a soldier called John Hussey. It's now gone back to Doddington Orley, Lincolnshire, from whence it came. And what was interesting about this breastplate is it had a bullet hole along its top. So clearly a bullet had been struck by a bullet. And John Hussey also wore a buff coat underneath his breastplate. And
it's a sort of leather undercoat.
It's a leather undercoat, effectively. And it was worn for comfort, because you've got a metal breastplate. Yeah. And if you haven't got anything under it, it's going to chafe all day. Okay, so you wore a buff coat. If you didn't wear a buff coat, you were known to be in the buff, which is the origin of the modern term for naked. Okay, and that's where it comes from. Well, we've got the complete uniform of John Hussey, because it was preserved by his family. So we've got the breastplate that clearly has a bullet hole in the top. His buff coat has the hole where the bullet's gone through the metal and into his chest, if you like. And we know exactly what happened to John Hussey. John Hussey was a young man. He fought for the Royalist side. He fought at the Battle of Gainsborough, which is not too far away. It's near Lincoln. It was a Royalist stronghold. And Cromwell came to try and take Gainsborough away from the Royalists. He was shot, quite clearly, by a musket ball. And we know what happened. The musket ball went into him, but he didn't die straight away. He very rarely did die straight away. He was taken back to Doddington Hall, which was his ancestral home.
So it's gone into the right side of his chest. Yeah. Now, if it had hit him on the left side, he'd probably be dead pretty much straight away, hitting his heart.
Yes, yeah. So it's obviously gone in, but it's gone in at an angle as well. So it could well be that he's been shot from a horse, a parliamentarian cavalryman, with perhaps a pistol. You know, they would carry one pistol and fire one shot and then get their sword out. It looks like that might have been that. Perhaps he's been unhorsed, he's on the ground, he's been shot from above. So it's entered his basic chest. We know he lived on for some time after that, a matter of 24 hours, I think it was. So it's gone into his lung. One of the key problems that he's got at this point, and soldiers did have, is that it's taken some of the buff coat into it, the musket ball, and that's the source of infection. That's often what will happen. We've had a pathologist do some sort of an autopsy using the evidence we've got, and before, as we can see, their conclusions that, you know, this would have damaged the blood vessel, windpipe pushed towards the left side of the body. That would have made things very difficult and painful for him. Breathing would have been difficult. His heart would have been under quite a lot of pressure. He could have died from a number of things, heart failure, suffocation, infection, but it was a prolonged agonising death, and he would have been infected as well by the buff coat. And that's quite gruesome, isn't it, in a way? But that's the fate shared by so many people during that period. Oddly enough, we know that his arm that he's using, he's obviously quite a, he's a, he's a son of a landed individual, you know, a wealthy individual. His arm seems to have been something of a family heirloom, because it belongs to a previous period. And because of that, it's actually not very good. And so he would have been better off using, in inverted commas, modern breastplate, and that might have stopped the musket ball from entering. But in actual fact, he's got a very old piece of kit that probably dates to the previous century, and that was his downfall. I really like the object because it's poignant. We know the man that wore it. We know what happened to him.
Richard Darn there, speaking to me from the English Civil War Centre in Newark, talking about the death of John Hussey, the Royalist, one of 200,000 British people that lost their lives in the English Civil War in the 17th century, out of a total population of 4 million. That's 5% of the population that died in that war. That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Sue Jones, P. Pete Edwards and Richard Darn from the English Civil War Centre, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, at prsc.org.uk. Also, Volunteering Bristol. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the national volunteering site, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now. I'm gonna go to bed.
Another wonderful record. It's been a great week for records. I look forward to playing that next summer at festivals at dizzying volume, if there are festivals and if I'm invited to do them. New Order, of course, but that's been reinvented, really, by Fluke.